Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. In today's session, I'm going to do something a little unusual and read a paper. This paper is entitled Psychedelia and the Story of Stories, and an earlier version of it was presented at the Breaking Convention conference in 2013. Psychedelia and the Story of Stories. In this paper, I attempt a broad philosophical reflection on the matter of psychedelia, in the hope that it will be useful in helping us to situate, interpret, and evaluate psychedelic experience and its cultural expressions. But what is philosophical reflection? By philosophical reflection, I mean that peculiarly careful approach to what seem like significant conundrums, which attempts to dig a little deeper than is customary, to examine critically what is presupposed, both by questions and the common, obvious, or accepted answers to them. Furthermore, philosophical reflection, however abstract, is always haunted by utopia and the promise of the good. This primordial feature of philosophical reflection is nowhere better seen than in the questioning activities of Socrates and the Buddha, and I propose to allow them a structuring role in what follows. The crucial question posed by Socrates, remarkable for being both existential and political in scope, is: how is life to be lived? Buddha, for his part, asks, what to do about human suffering? These two necessarily intertwined questions, I propose, can usefully be amalgamated thus: how is life to be lived in order that we may flourish and endure less unnecessary suffering? For convenience, I call this the Socratic question. With this in mind, my starting point is simply to ask the basic, naive questions. What is the nature of psychedelia, its defining experiences and its expression in culture? This quickly proves to be an overwhelmingly fertile set of questions for a philosopher, not least because psychedelia is shot through, willy-nilly, with the same concerns that characterise philosophical reflection. Philosophy can examine psychedelia, but psychedelia can also examine philosophy. This paper accordingly takes the form of a multifaceted word picture in which psychedelia and philosophy reflect each other in the manner of facing mirrors. If there is a conclusion as such, it is that psychedelia, however much it becomes respectable, must retain its countercultural credentials. So what does psychedelia look like to philosophy as I've just characterised it? Well, firstly, let's note that the impact of psychedelic experience often results in big attitudinal and behavioural life changes in those individuals who have had it. And there are many famous examples of this. Furthermore, psychedelic researchers of all hues are engaged with psychedelic substances precisely because the ingestion of such substances does hold transformational promise, though of uncertain significance and scope. This applies to the entire spectrum of researchers, from the anarcho-dionysiacs of the magic bus to the hypothetico-deductive workers of the neuroscience laboratories, to the hermeneuts of the psychotherapist's office, to the shamans, both old and new style, whose concern is transformative personal encounter with mythos. It is as though the act of initiating a psychedelic experience, if reflectively undertaken, is in itself an asking of the Socratic question. Philosophy sees personal transformation written large all over psychedelia, and necessarily alongside that, the connected question, how should I live? Let's expand on this theme for a moment. The Socratic question is indeed primordial, and psychedelic experience reminds you intensely of that fact. But how is life to be lived is more than just a personal question. It's a political question about the good human life and the social organisation that could deliver it and the culture that could uphold its value and preserve and pass on its traditions. We can see this political aspect of the Socratic question in action, wielded by Socrates himself in Plato's Republic, one of the founding documents of Western philosophy. Moreover, we see the relationship between this collective political questioning and the individual existential questioning, particularly when this latter is focused on the matter of desire. On the individual level, so Socrates presumes in the Republic, the question, how should I live, inevitably becomes the question, what do I desire? He then proceeds to tease out the form of social organisation that would be needed to satisfy all the desires of a group of young, aristocratic Athenian men by questioning them closely. It's interesting to say the least that the form of social organisation derived from this dialectic on desire is a gruesome fascist state ruled by philosopher kings. These rulers are committed to their personal, possibly psychedelic, quest to fly upwards to the Empyrean, wherein all mysteries are encountered, all truth is revealed, and the perfect good resides, whilst at the very same time ruling the just city. One of their chief strategies for ruling is to tell the populace, the plebs, noble lies. The absolute truth is deemed too dangerous for them. The question of how life should be lived almost inevitably drives the inquirer towards this type of semantic ascent, since really true answers to the question require an unimpeachable account of inquiry itself, held up by thoroughly grounded notions of truth and the good. The psychological drivers here are a kind of propositional conscience and a desire for a kind of enlightenment understood as a personal transformation consisting of an enlarged understanding. One suspects that the good Socrates is actually being ironic here and not actually recommending the just city ruled by philosopher kings. After all, his stated preference as far as social organisation and culture are concerned is for bucolic simplicity and pleasure in the laughter of one's grandchildren and what looks like a Zen-style non-metaphysical spirituality. The aristocratic youths disparagingly call this the city of pigs. Also, Socrates' disavowal of any enlarged understanding on his own part, his recognition of only his own ignorance, reinforces the reading of the Republic as an ironic text, which attempts to subvert human intellectual and political hubris. The story of the Socratic question has several strong resonances with marked themes in psychedelic culture and available reportage of psychedelic experiences. Let's examine a few of them, allowing psychedelia to look back at philosophy. We've already considered transformation, now it belongs both to the Socrates story and to the psychedelic experience. The notion does indeed do much to structure narratives which are popular within psychedelic culture. Stanislav Grof, for instance, was centrally concerned to bring about the transformation, understood as a profound healing through a psychedelic psychotherapy, and he practically and theoretically engaged with the theme of psychedelic transformation within these parameters very, very thoroughly. This is a research theme which is regaining momentum right now as the psychiatric profession reconsiders psychedelics, and there's a recent lessening of the tension in the political situation around psychedelic research allows. Other psychedelic researchers working in the 1960s sought to effect social transformation with the aid of psychedelic experiences. Relating the realm of individual desire to social organisation in precisely the same way that Socrates does. That particular eruption of enthusiasmos attracted the resentment and wrath of the establishment in much the same way that Socrates' activities did. He was tried, we must note in passing, for corrupting youth and sentenced to death. Though we are much more circumspect today than the psychedelic researchers of the 1960s were in the matter of revealing our enthusiasmos, back then it was rather the point. The instrument of social transformation was going to be, in the hippie movement's imagination at least, the personal, individual enthusiasmos itself. And instead of a grim revolutionary bloodletting, there was to be a massive party in which the prevailing fear of intense pleasure and the attitude of guilt towards it would be challenged and melted away in the fire of psychedelic consciousness. Though Timothy Leary was not Socrates, we should be a little careful about blaming him for the attenuation of certain academic privileges. Rather, we should be grateful for his exposing the true nature of the hegemon's grip on the academy and its concern for regulating libido, pleasure, jouissance, as well as thought. Personal transformation has been emphasised in another branch of psychedelic culture, the Eastern mystic wing. An early psychedelic manual, for example, was based on the Bardo Thodol, or the Tibetan Book of the Dead. In this quarter, oceanic spirituality, ego loss, emergence into the clear light is valued, as is the transformative power of oceanic experiences, which are construed as supremely enlightening and liberating. The historical role of psychedelics in Eastern spiritual practices is unclear, but it's highly likely that there has been one, if the account of Soma in the Vedas and its mention in the Bhagavad Gita and the brief discussion of
Aushadi,
or magical power herbs, in the Yoga Sutra can be taken seriously. This tendency can actually be situated in the Western philosophical tradition in Nietzsche's early account of the Dionysian, as outlined in The Birth of Tragedy, in which a re-entry into the primal oneness consolidates social identity and group cohesion through orgiastic rites, possibly fueled by a psychedelic draft. For Nietzsche, this tendency is a primordial Dionysian energy belonging to the human organism itself, ontologically prior to any shaping of the human being by culture. If he is right, we would be justified in seeing the orgy of 1960s psychedelia as a return of the repressed. Psychedelia also resonates on the same count of ego dissolution with some telling remarks made by Freud in his Civilization and Its Discontents. In the first chapter of that work, Freud questions the origins of religions as they might be found in the individual's universal life dramas. He firstly considers the oceanic feeling that results after ego dissolution and its possible relationship to the origins of religion. This is suggested to him by his friend Romain Rolland, who claims that this feeling is present for him most of the time and is somehow related to the practice of yoga. Freud says that he believes such feelings are possible and that his friend's reports are authentic, though he himself has not experienced anything like them. He interprets these oceanic feelings psychoanalytically as a regression to an earlier, lower stage of development of the ego, where it is relatively undifferentiated, still intimately connected with the Brahman, indeed with the limitless and the intrauterine state. Freud is reluctant to locate religion's origins here. Rather, he claims they lie at the other end of ego's developmental ascent to a condition of separation, differentiation and shelter under the Father's law. Freud is clearly talking about the Abrahamic religions with their Father God intent on enforcing a moral code and requiring his human creations to morally improve themselves, to attempt as a life project to get themselves to conform to an ideal revealed by the Father God as that which will please him and bring forth his protection and stay his punitive hand. Let's call this superego religion. The first scenario, the origin of religion in the oceanic feelings, can be seen, according to Freud, as rather the origins of mysticism, which then gets grafted onto superego religion in a later era. He may well be right. Even in the case of those religions which place a much higher value on mysticism than the Abrahamic religions, which tend to be officially suspicious of the oceanic feelings. Hinduism, Buddhism and Taoism, by contrast, all value oceanic consciousness highly and have developed whole cultures upon it. I think we can safely take a crucial distinction from this discussion of Freud's on what are a couple of essentially Nietzschean themes and put them to use. It is the distinction between religious consciousness of a superego type and religious consciousness of an oceanic type. Psychedelic ingestion seems able to invoke both of these modes of experience very vividly. A moral desire aroused by psychedelic experience for character reform through remorse of conscience is quite common and clearly has a utility if psychedelic therapy is going to treat, say, opiate addiction or alcoholism. This seems to be the preferred psychedelic experience of the ayahuasca churches of Brazil. The oceanic experience of the ego melting away is also quite common, and this tends to be championed by psychedelic users with an affinity for Eastern spirituality or an ecological vision of harmony or unity with Mother Nature. The variables which determine which way a psychedelic experience is likely to run, if it is going to be entheogenic at all, seems to be the subject's history, prior ontotheological commitments and constitution, and the famous set and setting. No doubt, dosage and the actual substance used are also relevant. At this point, I want to discern and emphasise the features that jump out at me from what is as yet, merely a narrative Rorschach blot generated by an imagined conversation between novel, complex entities carved out of philosophy and psychedelia. I see two complex narratives in dialectical interaction. The founding moment of Western philosophy, the imaginative reportage of the sayings and doing of Socrates by Plato, furnishes us with both sides of the dialectic. On the one side, Socrates is seen mapping out an ascent to another world, more valuable than ours, above ours, more perfect than ours. It's easy to value this ascent since it connects us with the good and endows us with knowledge and wisdom and more perfection of character. Psychonauts often recognise this and resonate with it. They have, after all, seen visionary landscapes, higher worlds of breathtaking beauty. It may well be that Socrates and/or Plato are themselves being driven by psychedelic experience along this trajectory. It's highly likely that both took part in the Eleusinian Mysteries, in which the ceremonial drink, kaikion, was imbibed, possibly with psychedelic affect. But this is also the trajectory of superego religion, since a propositional conscience, a strong impetus to find the truth for moral reasons, to perfect character, is present and crucial to the whole movement of ascent. It is also, in virtue of its verticality, connected with hierarchical, authoritarian social organisation. On the other side of the dialectic, over and against the verticality of otherworldly Platonism, is the horizontality of Socrates, the champion of the anarchistic city of pigs. such as Socrates would practice a rural pantheistic oceanic religion. If he used a psychedelic, he would use it to facilitate the village orgy, the great Dionysian leveling, the collective deed that would remove the need and desire for hierarchies and instill an appreciation of this earthy world rather than a depreciation of it in comparison with some higher, more perfect world. Nothing is decided metaphysically by psychedelic experience. The reports are clear. It can reinforce either of the primordial psychedelic narratives I have tried to outline. Indeed, one can see the mind producing narratives. One can encounter the story of stories itself in psychedelic experience. And perhaps this is its greatest value. If we think that it's likely that our culture will become more of a psychedelic one than it already is, we perhaps need to consider and weigh the two primordial narratives as we take the decisions which will inform and which will inform the shape of that psychedelic culture. Will it be, we should ask, the city of pigs or the just city? Aldous Huxley, pioneer psychonaut, actually did a good job of imagining both. In Brave New World, written in 1932, a psychedelic drug aptly named Soma is an agent of social control in a horrible authoritarian society, not unlike Plato's Just City. Citizens are enabled to endure their mechanised lives by going on periodic escapist Soma holidays, trip sessions in purpose-built institutional surroundings. When I hear about the corporate ayahuasca spas that some pundits are fond of imagining as the future of psychedelics, I am reminded of Huxley's Soma holidays. In his last novel, Island, Huxley describes a version of the city of pigs. In a bucolic society, a culture given over to meditation, aesthetic pleasure, lovemaking, and eco-living has as a crucial feature, the use of moksha medicine, which is no doubt a psilocybin mushroom. Its effect is seen as a feast of meditation, and its use is integrated into a beautiful, easeful culture. It assists people through death and helps young adults to initiate themselves into the community of psychonauts, understood as fully alive human beings. Moreover, it is a tremendous aid to the creativity of free beings. I know which vision I prefer. In conclusion, the psychedelic experience is without doubt one of life's great dramas. Accordingly, those who have it are informed or even transformed by it and are prone to recommend it. But inasmuch as it is a psychedelic, that is a mind-manifesting experience, it will to some extent give us back vividly what we have made of ourselves, not necessarily in the full light of consciousness. For this reason, sober reflection, before and after the fact, should be its powerful adjunct, including careful evaluation of our desires for the human future.